On this June 16th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your Wednesday headlines. President Biden describing his first summit with Russian leader Vladimir Putin as good and positive, telling reporters, quote, "I did what I came to do." We'll have more from Geneva, Switzerland, and the analysis of New York Times White House correspondent Peter Baker just ahead. The head of the CDC is urging Americans to get the COVID vaccine as concerns rise over the highly contagious Delta variant. In a tweet, Dr. Rochelle Walensky writing, quote, "The vaccination is our ticket out of this pandemic." She points out that the new Delta variant, first identified in India, now accounts for 10% of the new cases here in the U.S. Meanwhile, travel restrictions across Europe are beginning to ease as EU countries start to reopen. Federal Reserve officials signaling that they expect to raise interest rates by 2023. That is sooner than anticipated just a few months ago. And what will changes at the Federal Trade Commission mean for big tech companies like Google and Amazon? We'll talk to one of the policy reporters for Axios.com about the new 32-year-old chair of the FTC. And this country will soon have a new federal holiday, with June 19th marking the end of slavery here in the U.S. based on congressional action this week. Just some of the stories shaping Washington Today, all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin in Switzerland, where President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin concluding their Geneva summit with an agreement to return their nation's ambassadors to the diplomatic posts here in Washington and in Moscow, while also renewing talks towards replacing the last remaining treaty between our two countries that would potentially limit nuclear weapons. But the two leaders offered starkly different views on some of the other issues, including cyber and ransomware attacks originating from Russia. We will break it all down, beginning with President Biden, his remarks at a closing news conference before heading back to the White House this evening.
You asked me many times, what was I going to discuss with Putin before I came? I told you I only negotiate with the individual. And now I can tell you what I was intending to do all along. And that is to discuss and raise the issue of strategic stability and try to set up a mechanism whereby we dealt with it. We discussed in detail the next steps our country should take on arms control measures, the steps we need to take to reduce the risk of unintended conflict. And I'm pleased that we agreed today to launch a bilateral strategic stability dialogue. Diplomatic speak for saying, get our military experts and our diplomats together to work on a mechanism that can lead to control of new and dangerous and sophisticated weapons that are coming on the scene now, that reduce the times of response, that raise the prospects of accidental war. And we went into some detail of what those weapon systems were. Another area we spent a great deal of time on was cyber and cybersecurity. I talked about the proposition that certain critical infrastructure should be off limits to attack, period, by cyber or any other means. I gave them a list, if I'm not mistaken, I don't have it in front of me, 16 specific entities, 16 defined as critical infrastructure under U.S. policy, from the energy sector to our water systems. Of course, the principle is one thing. It has to be backed up by practice. Responsible countries need to take action against criminals who conduct ransomware activities on their territory. So we agreed to task experts in both our countries to work on specific understandings about what's off limits and to follow up on specific cases that originate in other countries, either of our countries. There's a long list of other things we spent time on, from the urgent need to preserve and reopen the humanitarian corridors in Syria so that we can get food, just simple food and basic necessities, to people who are starving to death. How to build it and how it is in the interest of both Russia and the United States to ensure that Iran does not acquire nuclear weapons. We agreed to work together there because as much as Russia's interest is ours. And to how we can ensure the Arctic remains a region of cooperation rather than conflict.
That summary from President Biden, he, by the way, did have the last word in terms of news conferences. He met with reporters only after the Russian leader had concluded his own separate news conference. The two did not share the same stage for a joint event. That directive came from the White House. And Vladimir Putin insisted that his country has not been involved in cyber attacks and ransomware hacks, and that he personally has nothing to do with those attacks. However, U.S. intelligence does indicate there is a direct connection with Russia. President Biden telling reporters that he made clear to Putin that if Russia crossed certain red lines, including going after major American infrastructure, as he outlined in those remarks just a moment ago, his administration, he said, would respond. More with President Biden.
U.S. intelligence has said that Russia tried to interfere in the last two presidential elections and that Russia groups are behind hacks like SolarWinds and some of the ransomware attacks you just mentioned. Putin, in his news conference just now, accepted no responsibility for any misbehavior. Your predecessor opted not to demand that Putin stop these disruptions. So what is something that concrete, sir, that you achieved today to prevent that from happening again? And what were the consequences you threatened?
Whether I stopped it from happening again, he knows I will take action, like we did when this last time out. What happened was we, in fact, made it clear that we were not going to continue to allow this to go on. The end result was we ended up withdrawing them. They went and withdrawing ambassadors. We closed down some of their facilities in the United States, et cetera. He knows there are consequences. Now, look, one of the consequences that I know, I don't know, I shouldn't say this, unfair of me. I suspect you may all think doesn't matter. But I'm confident it matters to him, a confident matter to him and to other world leaders of big nations. His credibility worldwide shrinks. Let's get this straight. How would it be if the United States were viewed by the rest of the world as interfering with the elections directly of other countries and everybody knew it? What would it be like if we engaged in activities that he is engaged in? It diminishes the standing of a country that is desperately trying to make sure it maintains its standing as a major world power. And so it's not just what I do. It's what the actions that other countries take, in this case Russia, that are contrary to international norms, it's the price they pay. They are not able to dictate what happens in the world. There are other nations of significant consequence, i.e. the United States of America being one of them.
By the way, today's summit in Switzerland, it lasted about 3 hours, both leaders suggesting that while enormous differences remain between Russia and the U.S., they described the talks as businesslike and constructive. And Vladimir Putin saying that there was, quote, no hostility during the conversation with President Biden. A recurring question for the Russian leader, though, links between his country and cyber attacks on American businesses. As heard through a translator, here's the Russian president during his news conference.
First of all, could you characterize the dynamic between yourself and President Biden? Was it hostile or was it friendly? And secondly, throughout these conversations, did you commit to ceasing carrying out cyber attacks on the United States? Did you commit to stopping threatening Ukraine's security? And did you commit to stop cracking down on the opposition in Russia?
The first overall evaluation, as far as that is concerned, I don't think there was any kind of hostility. On the contrary, our meeting was obviously a fundamental one. Many of our joint positions are divergent, but nevertheless, I think that both sides manifested determination to try and understand each other and try and converge our positions. And I think it was very constructive. As far as cybersecurity is concerned, we agreed that we would begin consultations on that issue. And I believe that's extraordinarily important. And obviously, both sides have to assume certain obligations there. I'd like to inform you that I think it's common knowledge, perhaps not to the public at large, but the American administration, I don't want to actually say which body it is, but American sources say that the majority of cyber attacks in the world are, in fact, on the cyberspace in the U.S. And then the second place is Canada, and the third is U.K. On that list of countries, the cyberspace which which is most vulnerable, is not ours.
Now, at their summit in Geneva, President Biden did give Vladimir Putin a crystal sculpture of an American bison, which, of course, is the national mammal of the U.S., as well as a pair of custom aviator sunglasses. President Biden is the fifth U.S. president to meet with Vladimir Putin. He came to office back in 2000 as the Russian leader at the end of the Bill Clinton administration. And since then, Vladimir Putin has held summit meetings with Presidents Bush, Obama, Trump, and now Biden. He was asked today about his relationship with former President Trump and the dynamics today versus previous meetings with President Trump. Here's Vladimir Putin.
And once again, the conversation was quite constructive, and I once again understood that President Biden is an experienced statesman. Our one-on-one conversation took almost 2 hours. It's not every world leader that gets this amount of attention. I mean, his predecessor was asked the same question. He evaded this. This president decided to respond to the question directly. And in this, he is very different from President Trump.
With more on the summit in Geneva, Switzerland, we're joined on the phone here in Washington with Peter Baker. He is the chief White House correspondent for The New York Times. And in 2005, releasing the book Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin's Russia and the End of the Revolution. As you watch today's happenings in Geneva, Switzerland, did the president in any way move the needle, whether it's cyber threats, human rights, a New START treaty, or other issues?
Yeah, I think it looked more like a status quo kind of session, a session more aimed at laying down markers and positioning each side rather than actually making any kind of breakthroughs, right? I don't think suddenly Vladimir Putin woke up and realized, gosh, I'm going to call off all these cyber attacks on the United States. I don't think Joe Biden woke up and decided that Vladimir Putin is really a great friend of America. But I think both sides used the occasion to kind of sort of lay down red lines and say, you know, these are issues we're going to have to address directly. And from Biden's point of view, I think the goal is less to reset the relationship, as other presidents have tried to do, than to simply keep it from escalating beyond the rather confrontational status it already has.
There were a couple of moments in the dueling news conference, first with President Vladimir Putin, when asked about Alexei Navalny, who, by the way, he never mentioned his name in the NBC interview and again today. But Vladimir Putin very quickly defers to the events here in Washington on January 6th. Here's how that unfolded through a translator.
Mr. President, thank you so much for taking my question. President Biden has said that he would respond if cyber attacks from Russia do not stop. I'm curious, what did he tell you? Did he make any threats? And a quick follow-up, if I may, sir. The list of your political opponents who are dead, imprisoned, or jailed is long. Alexei Navalny's organization called for free and fair elections, an end to corruption. But Russia has outlawed that organization, calling it extremist. And you have now prevented anyone who supports him to run for office. So my question is, Mr. President, what are you so afraid of?
Okay. Once more, let me reiterate what was already said about various so-called foreign agents and about people who are positioning themselves as the non-systemic opposition. I already answered your colleague from CNN, right? But this is the law of the genre, so I have to answer your question, please. I'll do it again. The United States has adopted a law in accordance with which the U.S. has said that they will support various political organizations in Russia. At the same time, they made an announcement that the Russian Federation is an enemy. They've spoken publicly, saying that they will restrain the development of Russia. Here's a question. What organizations, what political organizations of the United States and other members of the Western community, which organizations should be supported in Russia, especially if they're paying for them? We're just like the Americans back, the way the Americans did back in the 1930s. We're calling them foreign agents. But it's not prohibited. They're not prohibited from working. They can continue to operate. Foreign agents don't need to stop operating. If they are extremist in nature, then that's another issue. The organization that you mentioned has publicly called for a mass disorder. They have publicly called for breaking the law. They called for minors to participate in activities that were against the law. And they were talking about using Molotov cocktails against the authorities as well, including against police. America just recently had very severe events after well-known events after a killing of an African American. And an entire movement developed known as Black Lives Matter. I'm not going to comment on that, but here's what I do want to say. What we saw was disorder, destruction, violations of the law, et cetera. We feel sympathy for the United States of America, but we don't want that to happen on our territory. And we're doing our utmost in order to not allow it to happen. And some fears has nothing to do with anything. Please.
That from Russian President Vladimir Putin through a translator, his news conference in Geneva, Switzerland, and Peter Baker of the New York Times. Clearly, he understands American politics and was able to very quickly pivot to issues here in this country.
He does, and it's classic Putin, okay? We've seen this now for more than 20 years. Anytime anybody raises any criticism of his government or his country's treatment of human rights or other issues, outside their borders, what you hear immediately from Putin is a whataboutism kind of response. Well, what about the Americans who invaded Iraq? What about Guantanamo Bay? And now he's got this new talking point. What about January 6th? Aren't you guys just suppressing political dissent the way I am? Why is it so bad that I put Navalny in prison when you're busy rounding up people who only wanted to protest an election at the Capitol? And of course, they're not equivalent. And that's the nature of this Russian tactic to try to make equivalent to things that are not. But it's a hard thing for Americans to have to counter, because then it puts them on the defensive and makes it harder for them, presidents and others, to put the focus on Russian treatment of their own people or Russian adventurism abroad.
Both leaders basically said the talks today were businesslike and constructive. Does that surprise you based on the tensions going into this summit meeting?
Well, I think it's a bare minimum, right? In other words, they didn't yell at each other, they didn't scream, and they didn't come out of their meetings hurling invectives or insults, but neither did they come out expressing any kind of warmth toward each other. They didn't come out saying, gosh, we really found each other to be friendly partners. You could tell in this relationship that there is tension and friction even as they are trying to find a way to talk. It looked to me, just from listening to the press conferences afterwards, that they both went through their talking points. They both made their, the assertions that they wanted to make when they walked in the room, but neither walked out having changed their mind about anything. That may be good in the sense that talking is often better than not. But on the other hand, there are people who worry that just simply having this meeting was premature because it gave Putin a platform. It let him get out of the box to the extent that the West has tried to put him in one over the years. Certainly President Trump let him out of that box too. But may not have done much to accomplish anything.
And Peter Baker, as the co-author of the book with your wife Susan Glasser, The Man Who Ran Washington, a biography of former Secretary of State James Baker, today's summit in Geneva really did have the feel of a summit that Jim Baker would have organized. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, Baker, of course, the Secretary of State at the end of the Cold War, was a believer in talking with your adversaries as well as your friends. He believed that, you're better off trying to find areas of common ground than to focus on confrontations. That didn't mean that he was in favor of doing summits without a discernible possible outcome that would be useful. What he preferred to do was sit down with his interlocutors with something he could get out of it. But in general, I think he's a believer in diplomacy over, yelling at each other from across the ocean. And that's certainly where Biden's approach is today.
There was one moment, this exchange with CNN White House correspondent Caitlin Collins and the president at the end of the news conference with President Biden. Let's listen.
Families of the detained Americans came up and we discussed it. We're going to follow through with that discussion. I am not going to walk away on this.
Why are you so confident he'll change his behavior, Mr. President?
Yeah, I'm not confident changing behavior. What the hell? What do you do all the time? So when did I say I was confident?
You
I
said in the next 6 months you'd be able to determine.
What I said was, let's get it straight. I said what will change their behavior is that the rest of the world reacts to them and it diminishes their standing in the world. I'm not confident of anything. I'm just stating the fact.
But given his past behavior has not changed, and in that press conference, after sitting down with you for several hours, he denied any involvement in cyber attacks. He downplayed human rights abuses. He even refused to say Alexei Navalny's name. So how does that account to a...
I'm not actually hearing anything
if you're supposed to be. President Putin,
right? You don't understand that. You're in your own business.
It's a summit with China.
We need to love quickly. Let's go.
And Peter Baker, you have been in many of those moments. Your reaction?
Yeah, look, this is a president, obviously, who's a little testy, a little defensive about any suggestion that he's being naive about Putin, right? He doesn't want to be compared at all to his predecessor, President Trump, who seemed to be ingratiating and almost fawning at times over President Putin. And instead, President Biden's trying to say, I don't trust anybody. They have to earn that trust. So he returned to the reporter and was kind of snappish. He later, of course, apologized for being, quote, a wise guy, as he put it. But he stuck by his point, which is that he's not buying into Putin as a trustworthy partner necessarily, but he's going to try to do what he can to make progress where he thinks he can.
And as we heard from President Biden, that old axiom from Reagan, trust but verify, to President Biden, it's verify first and then maybe trust, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Trying to turn that around on it. Of course, Reagan had a different situation. Reagan was at a time when we were growing closer to Russia, and now, of course, we're growing further and further apart. And the idea that we could come to an accommodation or some sort of relationship the way Reagan and Gorbachev did seems very distant at this point.
Bottom line, what is the path forward for President Biden, President Putin, the U.S., and Russia?
Well, I suspect we're going to be in for a period of continuing tension and continuing disagreements on pretty important things over Ukraine, over cyber attacks, over the Middle East, and so on. And I don't know that we solved any of those today, but I think what the Biden ambition here is not necessarily to solve these problems, because as long as Putin is there, they recognize there's a limit to their ability to create a new relationship with Russia, but instead at least to keep things from getting worse, right? They don't want to be spending a lot of their time on Russia. They want to keep Russia in a box to some extent, to keep them from creating more problems on the international scene that the administration has to deal with. So instead they can be focusing on a foreign policy priorities that they would rather focus on. And so this kind of a meeting is meant to kind of tamp down the conflict and keep it kind of restrained, even if it's not going to solve it.
And one final question, Peter Baker, is Vladimir Putin firmly in control in Moscow, or is he feeling pressure internally in terms of the economy and internal politics? Critics aside,
I think he always feels some pressure internally, and that's why you see him react the way he does to protests, react the way he does to this Alexei Navalny movement to try to, declare it an extremist group. You see him waving the national flag in order to create an enemy outside the country to rally people inside the country behind him whenever he feels like he's in trouble because of the economy or because of other issues. And so I think that his domestic issues, while not the same as we see in the United States, because it's not a democracy and what we would consider to be a democracy, are still driving his policies toward the rest of the world in a lot of ways.
Peter Baker is chief White House correspondent for The New York Times, the author or co-author of 6 books, including Kremlin Rising, Vladimir Putin's Russia, and The End of the Revolution. He's joining us here in Washington. As always, we thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it. Great talking to you.
And welcome back to Washington Today for this Wednesday. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your other headlines. Royal Caribbean International postponing its first scheduled trip from the U.S. in more than a year following 8 new positive COVID-19 cases among crew members. The megaship Odyssey was expected to set sail from Fort Lauderdale, Florida on July 3rd. It's now been postponed until at least July 31st. And the heat wave continues out west. Consider this. That low temperature overnight in Phoenix was 91 degrees. Today, more than 40 million residents out west in Arizona, California, Nevada, seeing temperatures exceeding 100 degrees. The big concern, what these drought conditions will mean for the wildfire season. The chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, meeting with reporters today following a two-day policy meeting by the central bank. One of the headlines, look for interest rates to go up in 2023. That is earlier than originally telegraphed by the Fed. What's prompting the policy change? A much stronger economic rebound and inflation that is hotter than the Fed initially anticipated. More with Chairman Powell.
Inflation has increased notably in recent months. The 12-month change in PCE prices was 3.6% in April and will likely remain elevated in coming months before moderating. Part of the increase reflects the very low readings from early in the pandemic falling out of the calculation, as well as the pass-through of past increases in oil prices to consumer energy prices. Beyond these effects, we are also seeing upward pressure on prices from the rebound in spending as the economy continues to reopen, particularly as supply bottlenecks have limited how quickly production in some sectors can respond in the near term. These bottleneck effects have been larger than anticipated, and FOMC participants have revised up their projections for inflation, notably for this year. As these transitory supply effects abate, inflation is expected to drop back toward our longer-run goal, and the median inflation projection falls from 3.4% this year to 2.1% next year and 2.2% in 2023.
That update from the Fed Chair Jerome Powell. Now, the central bank has held overnight interest rates steady since March of last year. That's when the effects of the pandemic causing a sharp drop off into the U.S. and the global economy. The central bank has also been purchasing at least $120 billion a month of treasury and mortgage bonds since June of last year. The goal to hold down long-term borrowing expenses and provide further support to the recovery of the U.S. economy. So where do things stand with inflation and the prospect for higher interest rates? More with the Fed chair.
The committee's medium forecast on inflation seems to assume a pretty tame outlook for the rest of the year. As you know, the three-month annualized rate for the past 3 months was, I think, 8.4% in the CPI. And I'm just wondering sort of how much longer we can sustain those kinds of rates before you get nervous. Thanks.
So inflation has come in above expectations over the last few months. But if you look behind the headline numbers, you'll see that the incoming data are consistent with the view that the prices that are driving that higher inflation are from categories that are being directly affected by the recovery from the pandemic and the reopening of the economy. So, for example, the experience with lumber prices is illustrative of this. The thought is that prices like that have moved up really quickly because of the shortages and bottlenecks and the like, they should stop going up, and at some point they in some cases should actually go down. And we did see that in the case of lumber. Another example where we haven't seen that yet is prices for used cars, which accounted for more than a third of the total increase in core inflation. Used car prices are going up because of sort of a perfect storm of very strong demand and limited supply. It's going up at just an amazing annual rate. But we do think that it makes sense that that would stop and that, in fact, it would reverse over time. So we think we'll be seeing some of that. When will we be seeing it? We're not sure. That narrative still seems quite likely to prove correct, though, although, you know, as I pointed out at the last press conference, the timing of that is pretty uncertain, and so are the effects in the near term.
Today's news conference with the Fed Chair Jerome Powell. It can be found on our homepage. Check it out online anytime at cspan.org. And the markets are reacting to the news from the Fed. The Dow dropping 265 points. The Nasdaq was off by 33. The S&P losing 23. Meanwhile, the former Fed chair, now Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, testifying before the Senate Finance Committee today. Over the weekend, you might remember the G7 summit in Great Britain with member countries, which includes Canada and Japan, agreeing to support a minimum corporate tax rate of at least 15%. But some countries, including China, reluctant to give up tax incentives that would help their own individual countries. Here is one exchange from today's hearing with Idaho's Republican Senator Mike Crapo.
The administration has proposed a 15% global minimum tax at the OECD. However, the administration's domestic tax agenda includes raising our current global minimum tax, the GILTI tax effective rate, to more than 26%. And the administration appears to be pushing for changes to U.S. law before any other country has even enacted a global minimum tax. A number of countries have pushed back on the idea, including Ireland, Hungary, and India, and most notably, China. In fact, there are even reports that China will not sign a global minimum tax without carve-outs for its companies and tax policies. So my first question is the administration's position that the U.S. should increase its global minimum tax, the GILTI, or its minimum tax, to an effective rate of 26% before others, including China, enact a minimum tax themselves?
Well, we have proposed a global minimum tax effective rate of 21%, not 26%. And what we're working toward internationally is a global minimum tax that is at least 15% and hopefully higher than that. What the G7 agreed to in London last week was that they would adopt a global minimum tax at least 15%, not 15%, but hopefully higher than that. And I think if we're able to make progress domestically on reforming our GILTI, which needs to be on a country-by-country basis rather than a blended basis, and ourselves move it into the same territory we're asking other countries to do, I think we have a very good chance of getting them to agree. We're really looking for agreement on this by the time of the leaders' G20 summit next October. I think we have a very good chance of getting very broad-based agreement on this in the OECD. And
so it sounds to me like you're saying that you think the United States should move first, regardless of whether there is a global agreement.
Well, I think we're trying to move these things in tandem.
That's from the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. One other note, finance officials from the group of 20 major economies, which does include China, will be focusing on that issue of a global minimum tax proposal. They meet next month in Venice, Italy. Also from today's Senate Finance Committee hearing, a question from Michigan's Democratic Senator Debbie Stabenow on the current state of the U.S. tax system and its impact on U.S. taxpayers.
So we see tax rates that are unfair, and then we see folks not reporting income, hiding income, and so on. So could you just speak broadly about when the president is talking about tax cuts for working people and then asking folks, everybody to pay their fair share. And frankly, I don't think it's a tax increase to ask a billionaire to pay more than zero on their taxes. People in Michigan don't think that. But could you speak just in the big picture about right-sizing the tax system and making sure that everybody pays what they are supposed to be paying?
Thank you for that question, Senator. President Biden feels that it's crucial that we have a tax system that's fair, and one where we enforce tax laws so that individuals and corporations pay what they owe. And we really need to do that in order to assist hardworking low-income families, for example, with the child tax credit that you mentioned that is working now to reduce child poverty by almost 50% and give children and families the opportunities they need to succeed in America and to get ahead. As you pointed out, there's an enormous tax gap. One number we've been using, one estimate, is that it will amount to at least $7 trillion over the next decade. And it largely reflects shortfalls in collections for high-income individuals and corporations.
With that from the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. She testified before the Senate Finance Committee. Yesterday, we reported that the Senate confirmed Lina Khan to serve on the Federal Trade Commission. Just a few hours after she was confirmed by the Senate on a bipartisan vote, the White House naming her the chair of the FTC. Axios.com writing that this move makes it clear the Biden administration is, quote, serious about antitrust enforcement aimed at Google, Facebook, Amazon, and other Silicon Valley companies. Late this afternoon, we spoke to the tech policy reporter, Ashley Gold, to get more details on the FTC and its new chair.
Lena Khan is a 32-year-old law professor who's been an associate professor of law at Columbia, who is well known for her pretty bold and non-traditional views on tech and antitrust, and has made quite a name for herself in the tech industry and among antitrust people and scholars for her new views that have kind of shaped new ways of looking at antitrust for the digital age.
One example that you point out in your piece at Axios.com is how Amazon views its retail businesses and its various platforms. So explain how she views that and potentially what it means for a company like Amazon.
So Chairwoman Khan thinks that it is not right that a platform like Amazon that connects sellers to consumers should also be a seller of products themselves. She thinks that there are unfair advantages to Amazon owning the platform and running the platform and also selling on the platform. She thinks that should be structurally separated so that Amazon can either be a seller or a platform, but not both.
Her confirmation yesterday in the Senate by a vote of 69 to 28, so it was bipartisan. Her announcement just a few hours later that not only will she serve on the FTC, but she will serve as the chair, the significance of that?
It's pretty significant. A lot of folks in Washington were taken by surprise. Historically, this is not how the White House names the chair of the Federal Trade Commission. Usually, they make it known well ahead of the Senate confirmation who they desire to be chair. So for the White House to do this so quickly was pretty surprising to a lot of people and not normally how things go.
You talk about Amazon. What about other big tech companies like Google, Apple, and Facebook? Potentially, what could they face?
They could face Chairwoman Khan bringing aggressive cases that call into question their longstanding business practices, or she could take a look at current cases before the Federal Trade Commission, which includes an open investigation into Facebook, and take those in a more aggressive direction. She could bring new cases, and if she is empowered by Congress to enforce new laws, then things could get really hard for the tech companies.
We're talking with Ashley Gold of Axios.com, and if we could just take a step back, what is the Federal Trade Commission? What is its mission statement? How much authority does it have on American businesses?
So the Federal Trade Commission is the agency that is charged with protecting American consumers from fraudulent behavior, deceitful business behavior, and violations of privacy. So essentially, the FTC exists to protect consumers. So in the past, you know, that could have been a business defrauding their consumers, lying to them, charging them unfairly for services they didn't receive. But as we get more and more into the digital age, it's more complicated because the rules that we have on the books were not written for the digital age. And so much of how consumers are served now is online. So we've been watching this sort of revolution, you know, play out at the Federal Trade Commission, and it hasn't always been easy for the agency to keep up. But they have shown an interest in doing so in the past couple of years, and having someone like Chair Khan at the helm is definitely going to accelerate that.
And the headline of the new FTC chair already rocking boats at Axios.com. Ashley Gold here in Washington, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
In other news on this busy Wednesday, the Justice Department today dropping its lawsuit against President Trump's former National Security Advisor John Bolton over the publication of his tell-all book, The Room Where It Happened. The move comes a year after the Trump administration suing John Bolton in federal court, claiming that he had breached his contract by failing to complete a pre-publication review for classified information. Also today, a federal appeals court affirming that North Carolina's ban on abortion after 20 weeks of pregnancy is unconstitutional, in part because it poses the threat of prosecution to those abortion providers. The ruling was unanimous as the U.S. Supreme Court takes on a separate Mississippi case that likely will be a test on the constitutionality of abortions. The Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer announcing today that he would back a bill to repeal the 2002 authorization of the use of military force in Iraq, known as AUMF. The move will tee up a Senate vote later this summer. More from the Senate floor.
2 days ago, the Biden administration became the first administration since the beginning of the Iraq war to support repealing the authorization for the use of military force in Iraq, passed in 2002 and now in effect for 19 years. The Iraq war has been over for nearly a decade. An authorization passed in 2002 is no longer necessary in 2021. It's been nearly 10 years since this particular authorization has been cited as a primary justification for a military operation. It no longer serves a vital purpose in our fight against violent extremists in the Middle East. So, Mr. President, I strongly and fully support repealing the 2002 authorization for the use of military force in Iraq. This is the first time I'm formally announcing my support for repeal. I want to be clear. In no way will America abandon our relationship with Iraq and its people as they rebuild their country after years of war and our shared fight against ISIS. But there are very good reasons to repeal this specific legal authority. For example, it will eliminate the danger of a future administration reaching back into the legal dustbin to use it as a justification for military adventurism. At the beginning of last year, we saw that danger become frightfully real when President Trump ordered an airstrike against an Iranian target in Iraq without transparency, without proper notification to Congress, and without a clear strategy. President Trump cited the 2002 AUMF as partial justification ex post facto, a claim that legal scholars and foreign policy experts resoundingly rejected. There is no good reason to allow this legal authority to persist in case another reckless commander-in-chief tries the same trick in the future.
Those remarks by the Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer. We carried it live on C-SPAN 2, the resolution being co-sponsored by Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia and Republican Senator Todd Young of Indiana. The issue will be taken up next week by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and you can follow the debate on the C-SPAN networks. And finally, the Senate voted yesterday, the House later this evening, making June 19th a federal holiday. Juneteenth, as it's called, marking the true end of slavery here in the U.S. It commemorates June 19th, 1865. That's when Union Army General Gordon Granger proclaiming freedom from slavery in the state of Texas, nearly 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, the holiday has been celebrated in 47 states and here in Washington, D.C., but now it will be recognized on a national level. In the Senate yesterday, Democratic leader Chuck Schumer making the motion to pass the legislation. No other senators objected. Earlier, Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson dropping his objection to the holiday. This will mark, with the president's support, the 12th federal holiday in the calendar year. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast. Be sure to listen and follow wherever you get your favorite podcast and follow all of our coverage on the web at cspan.org. For the Wednesday edition of Washington Today, I'm Steve Scully, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.